and welcome to Historical Hysteria. Today we are talking about the myth of the right to bear arms. No, not the right to have arms of a bear, but the right to bear firearms or weapons. Now, I'm not going to get into debates around the meaning of the American Second Amendment. That is a thorny topic on which I have no authority whatsoever, because believe it or not, I am not a constitutional lawyer. Never have been, probably never will be. I mean, I could point out there has been an accepted long-standing definition and understanding of the Second Amendment between, you know, like 1782 and like 1970, which held certain things to be true about the right to bear arms, which were only overturned once the NRA turned into its full-on weapons manufacturing lobbyist form and after a conservative backing of the court. But I'm not going to get into those right now, other than what I already just did, because like I said, I'm not going to comment on the obvious stupidity of the modern definition of the right to bear arms. What was I saying? Where was I? Who am I? Oh yes, the Second Amendment. Specifically, I want to talk about this. The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And that the only defense against autocracy is an armed populace. Two extremely popular myths amongst Second Amendment gun-toting certain types of people in America. A common myth, especially among American gun lovers, is that an armed society is the best and arguably only way to maintain a free society. It seems to go over their heads that both the UK and America were near universally armed societies throughout the 15th, 16th, 17th, and 18th century, and yet it did nothing to prevent the monarchy existing. But whatever. The myth, however, posits that it was America's extensive population of armed commoners that won the revolution and has prevented the rise of autocracy ever since. For a minute, I'm going to put aside the countless universally armed states in which autocracy has arisen, like Afghanistan or Somalia, and instead focus on the idea that an armed populace prevents autocracy, like in the United States in 1775. So let's skip back to the American Revolution. In 1775, with the build-up towards independence, Benjamin Franklin would hold secret meetings with French envoys to discuss support for insurrection. Following these discussions, French envoy Julien Bonvalleur, I definitely got that pronunciation wrong, would report ecstatically to his superiors in France, quote, "Everyone here is a soldier." A few months later, Silas Deane, representing the would-be revolutionaries, would be sent to France negotiating for arms and ammunition to equip 25,000 soldiers, military engineers, clothes, and a line of credit. Deane would return to America with everything he had asked for and more, with his ship overloaded with French guns, French clothing, French boots, French gold, and French gunpowder, and French engineers. And with these, he outfitted the first Continental Army. Between 1775 and 1783, France would supply the American colonists with 80% of their gunpowder. At Saratoga, it is estimated that 90% of firearms were French. Nearly half of all American spending during the war came from France and Spain, and around 34,000 Frenchmen and 64 French warships would fight alongside the Americans during the Revolution. This accounted for the Patriots' entire naval force and about a third of the Continentals under arms during the entire war. But what about the colonists' guns? Why did the near universally armed society of soldiers need a third of their fighting force and all of their guns to come from an outside power? Where were Bonvalleur's soldiers? Well, besides the Continental Army, there was, of course, the American militias. The total soldiers under arms across 8 years was about 80,000 within the Continental Army. However, among the militia, this number was closer to 200,000. So, case closed. The fighting strength of the people won the revolution. If including the militia, the French fall from a vital one-third of forces to a paltry 14%. Surely it was the militias who won the day, proving beyond a doubt the effectiveness of an armed society. So what did George Washington and the general staff think of the self-armed, self-trained, self-led Americans? Well, let's let them use their own words. On September 30th, 1776, at the very beginning of the war, when the Continental Army needed every single man it could lay its hands on, George Washington wrote to his nephew, quote, "I am wearied to death all day with a variety of perplexing circumstances, disturbed at the conduct of the militia, whose behaviour and want of discipline has done great injury to the other troops, who never had an officer, except in a few instances, worth the bread they eat." End quote. Now, the rebelliousness of the militias has at times been rewritten as the indomitable spirit of the Yanks, and some successful militias were reformed as part of the Continental Army, most notably the Hearts of Iron Militia, formed by King's College students and briefly led by a young Alexander Hamilton. However, remember, Washington is complaining about the militias in 1775, at a time when the Continental Army is in full flight from the British. In fact, through the rest of the war and after, Washington's writings show less a vital force and more a huge hindrance. Militias generally acted as completely separate groups from the army. Their officers were elected and they behaved really however they wanted. They saw little action and were considered at best a vaguely beneficial pest and at worst an active threat to the security of the Continental Army and the new state. At the end of the war, the Continental Army had about 30,000 troops under arms, while the various revolutionary militias had over 100,000. Now, for reasons forever lost to history, the Founding Fathers would insert numerous concessions and allowances for militias into the Constitution, despite hating the ground on which they walked. No historian has ever come close to understanding why the Founding Fathers felt the need to insert concessions to hundreds of thousands of barely controlled armed thugs terrorizing the countryside. I mean, patrolling the countryside. Total historical mystery. Regardless of what you think about the Second Amendment, there are numerous reasons why an armed society is different to an army. For starters, guns wear out. The majority of guns owned by the colonists were hunting weapons, which saw limited use. Once you move into wartime footing, where you are dragging your weapons across half the country and constantly using them, they break. The taxing need for a constant stream of supplies was something that local industries just could not provide, which is why the French provided 80% of the gunpowder used in the revolution. Similarly, while proponents of the Second Amendment often point to armed militias as vital to the revolution, they generally ignore the other heavily armed societies which didn't overthrow their governments, like, for instance, the United Kingdom. In fact, throughout most of its history, the tyrannical UK had a near complete right to bear arms. In 1181, Henry II signed the Assize of Arms, which not only allowed a right to bear arms, but required it. And it was reaffirmed with harsher enforcement for those without weapons in 1252, and the age of requirement to bear arms was dropped to 15 and raised to 60, and requirement was expanded from freemen and up to villains and up by Henry III. This is the kind of thing that would be a Second Amendment proponent's wet dream today. The right to bear arms was briefly curtailed in 1594, and the government began seizing weapons from anyone it deemed dangerous. This was peeled back in 1662, then repealed fully in 1689 with a Bill of Rights that restored universal right to bear arms. The British Parliament would again curtail this right in 1715, but only for Highland Scots following the Jacobite Rebellion, first in 1715, then again in 1745. The Jacobite Rebellion, incidentally, was a case of a universally armed society failing to prevent autocracy. In 1765, Tory MP William Blackstone wrote about the right to bear arms, quote, "The last auxiliary right of the subject is that of having arms for their defence," end quote. He described this as part of the, quote, "natural right of resistance and self-preservation," end quote. And because of this, in 1775, American citizens had a universal right to bear arms, a right British subjects had enjoyed almost unhindered for 600 years. So why had such an armed society never overthrown its tyrants? Well, to answer that question, we have to jump back 600 years to 1181 and Henry II, and explore who Henry was and what he wanted. In 1181, the British monarchs were technically, but not actually, absolute monarchs. While the divine right of kings was an established practice, in effect almost every kingdom in Europe at the time, the monarch's powers were heavily kept in check by the power of the barons. The barons formed the backbone of the army, and if the king wanted to raise taxes or go to war or even scratch their arse, they had to carefully negotiate with the barons. King John of Robin Hood fame would learn this the hard way in 1215 when the barons revolted and forced the signing of the Magna Carta, which, incidentally, was a rebellion of universally armed citizens that only succeeded following foreign intervention when King Philip VIII of France joined the rebellion and was briefly sworn King of England. But why would a would-be tyrant want a universally armed populace? After all, within 30 years of Henry II's rule, it would lead to civil war. And more importantly, why am I bringing up 12th century politics when I was talking about American revolutionaries? Because the seized arms of 1181 and 1252 were, and still are, widely seen as an attempt by Henry II and III to secure their power and diminish the influence of the barons. Prior to this, kings relied on the might of the barons to assemble armies. Following the assize, barons found themselves as lesser partners in the traditional aristocratic relationship. After all, if the king can raise an army without the barons, what leverage do they still have? The first assize to arms was a major cause of the Baron War. In other words, the events of the 12th and 13th century are an excellent example of a government using an armed citizenry to centralise power and entrench autocratic control. So let's skip forward 8 centuries, leaving behind the knights in their armour and the revolutionaries with their muskets, to a dusty field in the northern state of Chihuahua in Mexico. Pancho Villa has just finished a long and brutal campaign overthrowing the Porfiriato in Mexico. Between 1857 and 1917, Mexicans had a right to bear arms. It is with these arms that Mexico's two most successful revolutionaries will take to the hills in the north and south and wage a decades-long civil war against Mexico's brutal dictatorship. And in 1915, having finally succeeded, they put down their arms and unite to form a new, democratic Mexico. Surely an example of a right to bear arms yielding the fruits of freedom. Well, no. Pancho Villa, during the revolution, believe it or not, spent as much time making movies as he did fighting the war, because he becomes almost entirely reliant on funds and weapons from America, specifically Hollywood studios, who send film crews to Mexico to get incredible shots of the war for the cinemas back home. You might know or have guessed what happens. Following a brutal civil war, Pancho Villa retires and is then assassinated. Then Mexico is plunged straight back into a brutal dictatorship and guns are banned in 1917. Yet another example of an armed citizenry failing to prevent autocracy. So let's skip forward 80 years to post-Soviet Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a more universally armed society than just about any that has ever existed, and there is an extensive and fascinating culture of small homegrown gunsmiths who still make and maintain many of the country's weapons. Afghanistan's armed tribesmen will fight off a British incursion in 1888, then again in 1891. The Russians will invade in 1987 and fight a brutal counterinsurgency that will virtually bankrupt the Soviet Union. In 1989, the Soviets fully withdraw, leaving Afghanistan to enjoy its first tentative breath of freedom. Now, there is a period of extremely complicated internal politics, and to simplify things, it does not end well. Chaos ensues, and across Afghanistan, warlords rise and fall. In 1994, Mohammed Omar is sitting in a madrasa in a southern town, where he hears news two women from the town have been abducted by a local warlord. He gathers his talib, students, and they take their guns and storm the compound, dragging the rapist warlord out and hanging him from the turret of one of his own tanks. An excellent example of armed citizens protecting the rights of the people that surely won't backfire. Omar and his talib will proceed to clean up Afghani politics and create a beautiful and stable republic. Oh, sorry, wrong cards. Omar will christen, Islamize, his new warriors Talib Ban, kind of a portmanteau of student and warrior, and they will rapidly seize control of the south of the country. The north, however, is controlled by Mahmoud Abbas, one of the most incredible generals and figures in Afghani and world history, in my opinion. Abbas will have the support of roughly 40 to 60% of the country, and between 1994 and 1997 will fight a war with the Taliban, slowly losing Kabul and the centre of Afghanistan till he is cornered in the Pashmir Valley, a dramatic mountain range in the northeast of the country. Hundreds of thousands will follow him from all over the country. He is immensely popular and has no shortage of volunteers, and a universally armed society. In 1997, he is assassinated and his region overrun, and the Taliban secure full control of Afghanistan. When the Americans arrive in 2001, it is the same people who followed Abbas into the mountains who will be the spearhead to retake Afghanistan from the Taliban. This is the Northern Alliance, who are still, to a small degree, the last force remaining against the Taliban in Afghanistan. Now, this was a very oversimplified history of Afghanistan, but here is a simple question. Why did a fanatic leading a bunch of insane cultists manage to seize control of an armed society that almost universally disliked them? There are a myriad of reasons, however, there is one that is difficult to ignore. By the end of the war, a majority of the Taliban's fighting forces were observed to be from outside Afghanistan. In 1996 and 1997, Wahhabists led and funded by Saudi Arabians poured into Afghanistan, as did Pakistani mercenaries and soldiers. Billions in aid and weapon were poured into the Taliban, and what a surprise, they won. An armed society was totally defenseless when it came to fighting a state-backed force. By comparison, the Afghani government, through a series of blunders, lost their domestic manufacturing abilities and subsequently had very little international support. Experts on the Afghan war argue that the only reason the Taliban was successful in 1997 was because of the aggressive foreign interference of Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. The Barons' War was only successful after the aggressive interference of French forces. And I'm sorry, Americans, but the American Revolution was only successful after aggressive interference by the French and the Spanish. This is not an attack on America. It's a breakdown of a modern myth, the idea that the right to bear arms will curtail autocracy. I personally am unaware of a single state in history in which can be said simply that an armed populace curtailed or prevented autocracy. Germany had a right to bear arms but couldn't stop the Nazis. In 1921, every other man and woman in Russia was armed to the teeth yet failed to stop the communists. And in 1949, and then again in 1956, a heavily armed populace failed to stop the CCP in China, just as a heavily armed populace had failed to stop the Kuomintang a few years earlier, and had failed to stop the Japanese during World War II. The universally armed Greek states, skipping back to ancient history, had the enlightened democratic Athenians, who were also a slave state, but they also had the barbarous totalitarian Spartans, who were also a slave state. This myth often uses the faulty logic that the Germans confiscated guns, then committed the Holocaust, therefore guns will prevent the Holocaust, while ignoring the fact that guns did not prevent the Holocaust. There was a society with guns, and they just handed the guns over, and then the Holocaust happened. Because when the state comes for your weapons, most people in most societies in most of history just give them up. And those who make war lose. Fighting a state without significant backing is near suicidal. That was true in the days of knights on horseback, and it was true in the days of muskets, and it's true today in the era of fighter jets and cruise missiles. And as has happened so often in history, armed populaces not only do not protect freedoms, but they're often used to destroy them. Mussolini and Hitler both began their rise with small bands of hyper-violent thugs in states with armed populaces. And the introduction of wide-scale civil chaos and violence into the streets was a significant part of the rise of these fascists. And these armed populaces then did nothing when autocracy was declared. In fact, significant portions of them aided the establishment of autocracy. If history demonstrates anything, it's that an armed populace is just as likely to support autocracy as it is to prevent it. The right to bear arms is not unique to America. It has been trialed over and over and over through history, and it is almost impossible to declare a consistent result. As I wrap up this topic, I want to be clear about something. Everything I have said is not proof or fact that an armed populace cannot stop tyranny, but rather it's a refutation of the myth that the right to bear arms is the only thing that prevents tyranny. The right to bear arms cannot be proven to prevent tyranny, just as the right to bear arms cannot be proven to cause tyranny. The world is more complex than that, and when people with loud proclamations shout down discussions and bulldoze dissent, it is not because their ideas are strong, but because they are too weak to stand up to scrutiny. The right to bear arms being the only bulwark against autocracy is simply a myth that is not backed up by history. It's easily disprovable. And the reason I have dragged you through this brief myth on the right to bear arms, whipping you from the dark, musty halls of the Dark Ages to the harsh deserts of Afghanistan, is because the world is varied. I am comfortable in saying that the myth of the right to bear arms is a myth, but I would not and will not say further. I might argue it in my personal life, but to make a blanket pronouncement of something like this is, well, pointless. I mean, myths surround us at every waking moment. Some of them are harmless and others aren't. What myths do you currently believe or sympathize with? What elements of your society, culture, or history do you just accept, even while knowing little about it? The annoying thing about myths is that they are easier than the truth. It is so much more inspiring to imagine the great heroes and epic struggles as pristine than it is to get into the weeds and confront the reality. Personally, I believe that simply discussing our beliefs to confront our own ignorance and shortcomings is the greatest weapon we have against extremism and tyranny. But that is a conjecture alert, a personal opinion alert. Sorry, personal opinion. But that is all we have time for today. Thank you for joining me. As always, feedback can be sent to historicalhysteria@gmail.com, and don't forget to check the socials, r/historicalhysteria on Reddit and @manichistory on Twitter. But before I go, let me leave you with this. When President Teddy Roosevelt died, his vice president said, quote, "Death had to take him in his sleep, because otherwise he would have put up a fight." Goodbye.